Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
So, ladies and gentlemen, my first message is that France is back. France is back at the core of Europe.
President Emmanuel Macron's apparent determination that France should command centre stage in the UK-free Europe. My guests Joy Lodico and Geoffrey Howard will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
I was groped several times. And I know that there are numerous other hostesses who said the same thing had happened to them.
The continuing fallout from the Financial Times expose of the President's Club's annual dinner for London's worst men. The promise of a much-needed unifying moment for a divided Great Britain in the shape of a visit by US President Donald Trump. And Slobodan Milosevic, the musical. Too soon. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Joy Lodico, columnist at the Evening Standard, and Geoffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. We will start tonight by considering President Emmanuel Macron of France. Last weekend, he was here in the UK, baffling the entire political establishment and media class by appearing on television and answering the questions he was actually asked and generally conveying the impression that he'd given the subject at hand any previous thought, as opposed to furiously winging it in the manner of a student who thought the book report was due next week. President Macron has moved on to the World Economic Forum at Davos, where he has informed attendees that France is back. Geoffrey, where does he seem to think it went?
Well, I think what's really striking about this is that he's not being dewy-eyed about the EU. He's speaking the language of reform. He's talking about problems we face on migration, problems we face about investment, problems we're facing about energy. And so I don't think he's trying to be the same kind of blindly optimistic, naive supporter of Europe that I think a lot of the Eurosceptics like to caricature. So I think he, in some sense, he's carving out a space for himself as a reformer. That's an important space. But at the same time, while he's doing that, I think he's really taking over the mantle as the one leader of the liberal democratic countries who's speaking the language of individual rights and universal human rights and fairness and equality. And that's really striking, I think.
Joy, do you get the sense that President Macron thinks that Brexit is something of an opportunity? It does leave France as Europe's only permanent UN Security Council member, its only nuclear-armed state. You can see, given the history between France and Britain, that the French would find it especially amusing if an act of British self-sabotage had handed command of the continent to them. But is that the way they're thinking?
Well, I think despite Macron's smooth words, he's cracking his knuckles with delight. So he was on a Eurostar train, I think in 2015 or 2016, when he was finance minister, saying he was ready to roll out the red carpet for British bankers when it's, should Brexit happen. And it's something he's repeated ever since. He's very smooth and charming, but he's actually been relatively ruthless about what's going on. And he knows that there's a huge advantage to Paris all of a sudden. You know, over in La Défense, they're talking about putting up seven new skyscrapers in order to house the British bankers they want over. The property company has a great line on it, which is tired of fog. What is it? Tired of fog. Welcome to the frogs, or come over to the frogs instead. So I think he sees that he has to maintain some sort of friendship with Britain, but he can also see that this is the point at which he can transform France, and the great Brexit dividend for him is what he can get out of us.
Geoffrey, he also said that we need a stronger Europe, which is, of course, no European leader is ever going to stand up and say what we need is a weaker Europe. So, to the extent
except
arguably Britain, but to the extent that that means anything, what does it mean when Macron says it? How does he want Europe to be stronger?
Well, I think what Macron is interested in is greater integration. I think what Macron is interested in is the cultivation of a pan-European identity. And only when we achieve a pan-European identity, where people take pride in being Europeans in addition to taking pride in being citizens of their own particular nationalities, their own particular countries, can we achieve the kind of cooperation that I think the EU was aiming for all along. An ever closer union means that at some point you need to have the kind of commitment morally, culturally to the project. And I think he's going to try to cultivate that. And I think one way, and this is what I was trying to touch on earlier, one way he's trying to cultivate that is by taking over this leadership deficit left behind by Donald Trump and saying, right, Europe, we can be the leader of the free world if we band together. And I think that's an exciting message for Europeans.
Joy, were you surprised from the point of view of somebody who is a journalist in Britain? How surprised the British media seemed to be last weekend when President Macron turned up on television and just sort of generally comported himself like a competent grown-up?
Well, I wasn't that surprised, but because that's partly because I read the Macron interviews that go round, and you can see that he can answer every single question with irritating charm and panache and detail. There was one interview in a German newspaper, which I think came out in October, where he was asked about his favourite novels, and he was just citing novels from North Africa, you know, this little touch of German novel. I mean, just, and you know, you just thought any British politician at this point would be stumbling and sweating desperately, trying to remember
Bravo
the last
to
time.
Zero,
yeah, the last time sitting there thinking of the, you know, the dog-eared Geoffrey Archer book on their side table. So are we surprised? This is a man with a vision. He's sat down, he's created a party, he's not actually having to deal with lots of different factions within his own party. Everybody's marching behind him. So that makes him rather different from a British politician, and that might be why I'm surprised he's so competent.
Geoffrey, if President Macron does wish to plant the tricolour in centre stage, that's a terrible metaphor, but you know what I'm saying. Is there actually any plausible rival to France once the UK leaves? Is there any plausible rival to France for base effective de facto leadership of Europe? Germany, for obvious historical reasons, is always very hesitant about staking such a claim. I mean, is France basically left in charge?
I think that's right. I think Germany's internal politics are quite difficult these days. Merkel's not going to be around forever. We know that. And what's coming next in Germany is very difficult to predict. So I think for the time being, France really is the only country that can play this role.
Well, let's move seamlessly from a visit by a foreign president, which was generally quite well received, to one which just may be less so. Because also from Davos, we learned that Britain has agreed, through almost audibly gritted teeth, to a visit later this year by US President Donald Trump. This news will obviously be welcomed by British retailers of cardboard, paint, sticks, and other materials used in the assembly of abusive placards, but the general response just might be more equivocal. Joy, they are, I quote, finalising details. Do we think that the British protocol mandarins are rather hoping that the finalising of these details might take some considerable time, possibly, let's say, at least 3 years, possibly seven?
Well, I think they would hope it would be after the midterms, just to see in case there's an absolute collapse and you can at least have an ego-dampened Trump in town. There is a protocol for these things, and the Queen will have to have stuff time booked out in her diary.
Well, not necessarily. If they can keep it away from being a state visit, he doesn't have to meet the Queen. If he arrives as head of government...
It sounded a little bit like it was going to be the state visit that was promised.
Really?
I can't imagine they can downgrade him at this point in time, given the fuss he's kicked up about the whole thing.
Geoffrey, as a representative of the Atlantic colonies. How excited are you by this prospect?
Not particularly excited. I mean, this is going to be one of the biggest protests we've seen in ages. I mean, I think the images are going to go all around the world, people seeing Britons come out in droves to protest the American president. I think historians are going to look back upon this moment in awe that two countries that are supposed to be so interwoven, so mutually committed, without any daylight between their policies globally, could be at such odds with one another, with the mayor of London basically saying that the president of the United States isn't wanted, with members of parliament saying he's not wanted. I mean, you think back of the relationship that Franklin Roosevelt had with Winston Churchill, and boy, we've come a long way.
Well, I mean, there was quite the turnout for George W. Bush, I recall, at the time. You think this would dwarf that?
I suspect it will dwarf that, absolutely. I think that George W. Bush was derided because of the Iraq War, because of the suspicion that he kind of pulled Tony Blair into the Iraq War unnecessarily. But I think he wasn't viewed as a fundamental threat to basic values of liberal democracy in the way I think many people view Donald Trump as a fundamental threat to the basic values of liberal democracy. And so I think really people are going to come out in incredible numbers.
I mean, Joy, this is... I mean, Geoffrey's right. I mean, there is a reasonable chance, I suspect, that a visit by Donald Trump could prompt what may be the single largest gathering of human beings in the history of these islands. Can they really bring him to London? Can they find a way to not have him visit the capital?
Well, they can just go around the Queen's palaces if they wanted to. They could take him off to some obscure islands. I mean, he's very fond of Scotland and the golf courses, and you could dot him around those. But he wants the photo opportunity. He wants to be in Buckingham Palace. He wants to be in Number 10. You know, he's got this love affair with Britain through his mother, who's Scottish. He's got a love affair with monarchy. If you listen to what he's talking about, a lot of it is about kind of dynasties and history. You know, his palaces are done up. You know, his interior decor is essentially Versailles or the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. All he wants is the pomp and ceremony. So, and he wants those carriages with those kind of lovely wooden wheels that go round. I think it's going to be very tricky, that photo shoot and the policing of it.
How would it be seen in America, Geoffrey, if the response is as we're all anticipating? Obviously, Fox News will just run a still of the crowds with enormous crowds greet arrival of Donald Trump,
right.
which will be no word of a lie. In fairness, that it may not be the whole truth, but it will be the truth. But for most Americans, will it kind of, given the relationship you mentioned, will it actually hurt if their president goes to the United Kingdom and receives that sort of reception?
I think it'll just be perceived through the standard partisan divisions. You're right. A bunch of people on the right are going to either point to the crowds and say, wow, look at that crowd size, right? It's even bigger than the inauguration, right? And Trump will spin it as though everyone was there to celebrate him. But I think on the right, it will also fuel a very familiar sense of, well, we don't care what the rest of the world thinks anyway. And so what if these Europeans come out to protest him? Good for them. It shows he's on the right track if he's bugging them, right? And then on the left, I think there'll be a great sense of shame and embarrassment.
Except I think there's a sort of love affair with the Queen that still goes across those political divides.
True.
So it's that photo op with the Queen and what people make of that.
Absolutely.
If he gets it.
I mean, Joy, speaking as a representative of your people at this table, should the citizens of one of America's sort of oldest and dearest allies respect the office, if not necessarily the occupant thereof?
No, I think the wonderful thing about democracy is that you should be able to shout, throw eggs, and complain bitterly. If Donald Trump had comported himself as a president should do in the office, I think we might take it a little bit more seriously. I mean, the W protests, I do remember, and they were significant, but they were very targeted. There was a very specific reason for it, and it was a policy dispute. I think this is a personal dispute with a president who's turned his presidency into a kind of personal battleground on Twitter.
Geoffrey, other news in Trump land is that Trump claims, and I quote, to be looking forward to speaking to the special counsel Robert Mueller, although not half as much, I'll wager, as Robert Mueller is looking forward to speaking to Trump. Do we think Trump will actually do this, especially if he is, I'm not sure of the technicalities, required to speak under oath?
I don't know whether he will do it or not. It's perfectly possible he's lying when he says he's looking forward to it. I mean, it's certainly not looking forward to it. And it's possible he won't do it at all. I mean, it really depends. But one thing we know, that if he does do this, if he does do it with Robert Mueller, we're going to be hearing a lot of him saying that he doesn't remember anything. We know that when he's done depositions before, there was one time when he was doing a deposition regarding a lawsuit with Trump University, remember that, in 2015, he 35 times in the course of the deposition, he said he didn't remember something. So I could imagine him interviewing with Mueller and then being a completely useless witness, because he'll basically just say he doesn't know anything.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mueller, along with Joy Lodico and Geoffrey Howard. Coming up next, lessons learned from the FT's expose of the President's Club, both for newspapers and, one would prefer to hope, the world's entitled oafs.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, Arjoy Ladiko and Geoffrey Howard. Now, here in the UK, the story of the week remains the expose by the Financial Times' Madison Marriage of the President's Club Charity Dinner, an annual charity fundraiser at which a guest list of male plutocrats is waited on by a temp staff of young women. Not altogether surprisingly, the report revealed what amounted to an evening's organised sexual harassment. In the days since, the President's Club has announced its closure. Many attendees have declared that they were shocked, they tell you, to learn that such shenanigans were occurring, and a veritable banquet of hot takes has been served by the media. Joy, first of all, the story itself, actually quite a surprising one from the FT, because, and I don't mean this at all disrespectfully to any tabloid newspapers, quite the opposite, it was a proper old-school tabloid gotcha, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I mean, they obviously have particular lines into it through their own business community, and I imagine the journalists in question were tipped off. There used to be an old joke about the FT, was they never did scoops, they were far too dignified for that sort of thing. If they got one, they'd call another newspaper up and ask them to run it, and then they'd just follow it up. And I think they've just realised the power, not just of this story, but it's the mix of women's issues with big money and patriarchy, and that's absolutely, you know, it's a huge story in the business community, and this is the first time we've actually had a series of names that you can play with and juggle with and embarrass over it.
I mean, it's a huge story. The dynamic you mentioned, sex, money, power, patriarchy, is a huge story everywhere. And on that subject, Geoffrey, is this a story that gets either commissioned or as much traction a year ago, pre-Harvey Weinstein?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think we really are living through a complete social transformation where social norms are in proper upheaval. I think this is a really spectacular moment to be part of, where we really are entering an era with the kind of conduct that has passed for most of human history as acceptable is now being viewed as unacceptable. And I think this is going to act as a serious deterrent to this kind of events in the future. Even if people's attitudes don't change, they won't want to get caught engaging in this kind of thing. So it's going to be prove pretty effective.
Well, on that subject, Joy, I'm always struck by stories like this, that the target once struck always caves. It's like they know they're doing something tacky, wrong and creepy. Otherwise, surely they would say, once exposed, yeah, and. But the President's Club has announced its closure. Lots of attendees and other people involved with it have either claimed they weren't there or didn't know what was going on, or were there but didn't really see anything in any way. They're terrifically sorry. Nobody will ever actually say, what's your problem? Do they know at some level that this is just off?
Do they know that it's off? Well, I think they do, obviously, because the legal letters are flying around at the moment in the background, various people saying we weren't there, or we do get a table, but I wasn't there in person. You know, the point about this story is they will have got this story because they knew the same thing had happened the year before and the year before, and it was a plant. They got two reporters in, or one reporter in, to actually be one of the girls and witness it. The idea that the people there who didn't know what was going on is also likely to be rubbish,
because what happened? Captain Renault defence.
Yeah, the Captain Renault defence. Because the chances are, you're like Martin Sorrell. They bought a table last year. They bought a table this year. Martin Sorrell may not be there in person this year, but he certainly was there last year. And I can't imagine the act has changed that much in the intervening time. The other interesting thing about this story is, when it came to Harvey Weinstein and the other stories, we tend to pick off one person individually. This one, and for Harvey Weinstein, we had to have 20 women come forward to get Weinstein. This one's flipped it. We've now got a list of, you know, 100 names of men who were there. The girls are largely anonymous. And there was a little bit of me today which was sort of quite delighted when, you know, if somebody calls this a witch hunt, you think, well, yeah, it's great, and look at the number we've rounded up this time.
Well, you're right in that this is an exposure of a culture, I guess you could say, rather than of individuals. And I mean, on that subject, I mean, I read the piece by Madison Marriage, which is a fantastic piece of reporting. Just perplexed, basically, because the thing I kept thinking, Geoffrey, was that it struck me as strange that it doesn't seem to pass through the minds of the attendees at any point the question, is this the kind of thing a total jerk would be at? This does seem kind of, I mean, at what point do the people at the event not think, is this right?
Well, I mean, this is more evidence that we live in a patriarchal culture. This is a giant moral blind spot, right? People don't realize when they're caught up in something pretty insidious. And part of the moral transformation is, part of the eureka aha moment is realizing that loads of us are embedded in some practices that are pretty terrible. Not most of us aren't embedded in these practices, but I think the lesson here is bigger, which is that... you know, here was an event where people were being systematically sexually harassed. And one of the things that's terrific about this story, and Joy was alluding to this, is that these are ordinary women, right? It isn't Selma Hayek coming out and saying, I've been abused. It's ordinary people. And I think one of the misleading things about in the aftermath of Harvey Weinstein is we have been thinking all about these famous people who have been abused. But it's really the ordinary people who work at theaters and restaurants and clubs who are experiencing this relentless sexual harassment day in and day out. And now the time is up for the sexual harassers. They can't get away with it anymore because people are going to talk. And what's striking here, and this is the biggest social norm change of all, people are believing them.
I think there's also another thing about this. There's a lot of people saying, well, you know, the girls were paid, you know, they knew what they're going for. If you're paid £150 a night, you're not being paid to be groped. That's, you know, double or triple restaurant wages, but it's certainly not full tart wages. So I think they have a right to complain.
Does the closure of the President's Club, though, Joy, feel like a big deal? Or do we think that similar things are likely to continue, but they might be under another name? They might be done by people who make more of an effort to do it discreetly, if discreetly is the right word?
Well, I think, you know, there are going to be several establishments.
I mean, I don't think the men who went to this event have changed their mind fundamentally about much in the last 72 hours or so.
Oh, I think you'll find they have, because the power of shame and the possibility that they lose their jobs means that they will be thinking very fundamentally about what they do with their... And this is not even social life, this is an extension of work life. These are tables paid for by companies who have codes of conduct, who sit there saying, we want to promote women. So I think they will have changed. I don't think you're going to be getting many expenses through for lap dancing clubs in the near future. And I would also imagine that there will be another number of people just sitting watching the established clubs, like, you know, the strip clubs, just to see who else is going in there with what paid tables. And well, I think it will. There will be a nervousness.
Geoffrey, we have seen among the flurry of responses, inevitably, quite a few pieces by, you know, Britain's professional contrarian opinion havers, either suggesting that, you know, worse things happen at sea, or that this isn't really all that bad, or, you know, this is like saying that, you know, an expose that the Vatican is full of Catholics and so forth. Do any of them have any kind of point at all?
No, I don't think so. And the thing about misogyny is eventually most of the people who are misogynists in this society are going to die, right? They're going to die out. And what's amazing about the transformation we're going through is that children are watching the news this morning, and the young generation of men growing up in a world where this is just, you just don't even consider sexual harassment as a possibility because you know you won't get away with it. And so I really think what's going on is that we'll have the next generation of kids will be people whose psychology is such that they just won't even think that this could ever be appropriate. And they'll be horrified by the stories about that. And I think that's a really wonderful development.
It would be pleasant to think you're right. Joy, to return to the coverage of it and the FT's coverage of it, and you mentioned before that this is something of a cultural shift for the Financial Times, perhaps. But as well as the report itself, which was terrific, and I do commend it to the remaining three people in Explored Space who haven't already read it, they did do a short film as well. Is that a way that newspapers should start thinking now, that it's not just enough to have the words on the paper, that even if you are a sort of lofty quality title like the Financial Times, you might need to lower yourself to pivoting to video every so often?
Oh, the great pivot to video. I think there is an idea that words don't necessarily tell all the story all the time, and that you could just sit there thinking, well, this has been embellished by a reporter, let us see the visual evidence. The visual evidence can lie just as much as the words can lie, depending on where it's taken, whether in, you know, the angle it's taken from, whether in fact it's real or not, which it will be with the FT. But, you know, a multimedia experience is very helpful also for getting a story to get to broadcast media, to get onto news channels and so forth. And I think all it does is just prove the case that they, you know, that the FT has been bold enough to do this story, and they've got every angle on it.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at further reinforcement for the argument that Mel Brooks' 1976 comedy The Producers may be a more prophetic satire than either Animal Farm or 1984. The dynamic of attempted willful failure by cynical opportunists being accidentally successful has already given us Brexit and Donald Trump. It is now about to bequeath something closer to the original vision of Bloom and Bialystok, a semi-sequel to Springtime for Hitler in the shape of Slobodan Milosevic, the musical. Jeffrey, it's going to be called The Lift. It is going to play in the Serbian city of Gratzenica, where I think I've been. I can't remember why or exactly when, but I'm pretty sure I've got a fridge magnet from there. Too soon, do we think?
Perhaps too soon for this kind of production. So what's interesting about this production is it aspires to portray Slobodan Milosevic in a quite multifaceted, complex light, to try to get at the full layers of dimensions of him as a person. That's very different from what The Producers was doing with Hitler. It's basically just making fun of Hitler, right? There was no sense in it was trying to honor the subtleties or nuances of Hitler's personality.
No, they were obviously also trying to crash and burn phenomenally.
Well, indeed, yes. Indeed. But with this, I mean, who knows whether this will crash and burn phenomenally, but I think it probably is too soon for ethnic Albanians, and to choose to do a portrayal of Slobodan Milosevic rather than a portrayal of the victims of the ethnic cleansing. It's an odd choice if the purpose is to commemorate this period of history. I think it's a legitimate pursuit, but one wonders whether it will be absorbed by the public culture, whether it's the right moment for it to be properly absorbed by the public culture.
Joy, is the issue not so much the subject as the medium? I mean, I don't see myself a particular problem with a theatrical representation of Slobodan Milosevic. Clearly an interesting, for want of a less charitable term, character. But musical theatre, does it inherently trivialise everything? This is all Hamilton's fault, isn't it, basically?
It is all Hamilton's fault. I mean, I used to go to musicals with my mother, who's a great fan of them, and they were kind of...
Everybody's mother's a great fan of musicals.
Just, you know, it just made her happy.
I don't know what that is.
It just sorted out every birthday, just take her to a musical, absolutely fine. And I grew to actually rather enjoy them as a result, because they are kind of cheese ball and fun, and they are, you know, opera light. I don't know, there are occasionally, I mean, I would call various modern operas heavy enough to take on a subject like Milosevic, but this does not seem to be so. It seems to be kind of show tunes. It seems to be an incredibly popular production. I mean, the thing I find intriguing with the piece I read on it said that they hadn't done the last scene yet, but the last scene was going to be happening at The Hague. It was the end of the war crime. You know, it was a war crimes scene. I thought, God, what sort of song number do you do to that? Is there a chorus? You know, is there a bridge in it? You know, how do you do it?
It seems likely to me that it may feature accordions. On the subject of operas, Jeffrey, the English National Opera did do one about Colonel Gaddafi in 2006, which I did not personally have the pleasure of. I have had the pleasure of reading some of the reviews, which I suspect were more entertaining than the actual production was, judging by those reviews. Is that okay? If you apply, say, a more serious musical métier to a serious subject, can you get away with that? Would Milosevic the opera seem quite as weird or askew as Milosevic the musical?
No, it wouldn't. I mean, this is the tradition. And I think that more serious musicals do try to resist this idea, and musicals like Les Miserables that aren't obviously an opera would be more naturally clarified as a musical, nevertheless try to tackle quite heavy subjects. So it is possible. I think the question is, what kind of musical is it going to be? Is it going to be fun and uplifting music, or is it going to be quite, you know, minor keys, dramatic music? And so I think we're going to need to go to see it. I don't know if it's going to come to the West End, but maybe we should all go see it if it
does.
Well,
I would be perfectly into a Midori House outing to Gratznica to see the musical. Joy, the logistics of getting there notwithstanding, would you be in the queue for a ticket?
Yeah, I would actually. I think it'd be a cultural phenomenon. It's always interesting to see how a character from history, you know, is portrayed. I haven't been to see it yet, but I would quite like going through the death of Stalin. I know that's a satire and it, you know, takes the mick at the right points in time. But you want to remember that those moments happen and then they get solidified in the culture afterwards. And you kind of want to see what people are then given as a sort of alternative history and what then seeps into their own stories of him.
Well, I await opening night with interest. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Joy Ladiko and Jeffrey Howard, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Leia Fournier. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. There's more music next. 1900, it's The Urbanist. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.